So welcome to another edition of the Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift. Back from a long break is Rafat Ali. Welcome back.
Thank you. Thanks for holding the fort while I was away. I heard it was a lot of good guest hosts, and I'm sorry I missed it, but I'm back.
Yeah, so tell us what it's like. Well, first of all, where you went and what happened and just what it was like being, I'm guessing you were somewhat disconnected from the media world and just from, you know, the world in general and electronic communication and all that.
Yeah, I was for most part. I mean, the only thing I was connected to, or I guess two things. Well, first, Facebook, because it was a personal trip, so it was more uploading photographs of the trips and all that stuff, and also Twitter to some extent. I think, but mainly as a broadcast mechanism as opposed to consuming content. So really, I was not that much in touch. Email to some extent, but nothing. I was joking that I don't even know what Pinterest is, because apparently the last 3 months has become huge, and I was away for last like almost 3 months.
What, you're living under a rock or something?
Apparently Pinterest is not that interesting in other countries outside of Silicon Valley.
Yeah, it's almost like you could leave and a whole new social network craze would start. By the time you got back, it was already over with. You wouldn't have to worry about it.
Yeah, that could happen, right? but yeah, I mean, it is interesting. Facebook is completely global. I went to, of course, UK, India, Burma, Comoros Islands, or the east coast of Africa, and Iceland. And two of those countries, Burma and Comoros, are very remote. Burma less so than Comoros Islands. And in both those places, you see how mainstream Facebook is. And then to some extent, I think Twitter to some extent, some people have heard of it, some people haven't. But Facebook, everybody uses. Everybody who's online, sorry, that's what I mean. Everybody who's online uses Facebook these days, yeah. Even in those kind of countries. So that was interesting. And people still use IM. I saw in a lot of internet cafes, local kids playing games, which I think is very universal, video games. And using IM, I think, because IM doesn't require, in these countries, the speed, internet speed is very low in general. So IM is a good way to keep in touch with other people without requiring too much bandwidth. So I think that's some of the reasons why. But it was interesting.
What was it like in Burma? Because you know, things seem to be politically and with the media there and everything, things seem to be really changing. You know, they're talking about opening things up, and now they've had these elections. Did it feel like things? I mean,
yes.
Was it kind of like a new day there in a way?
It is. I mean, it is. This was the first time that I went, so I don't have too much to compare to any previous trips. But even in this trip, you could. What was not possible 6 months ago, which is images of Aung San Suu Kyi on the streets everywhere, including all the newspapers and the print that has sort of exploded in the last year, and also T-shirts and stickers and of course the election happening, so I guess it was more than usual. But the fact that they could do all of this stuff was just incredible, and you could also speaking to people. Just the hope that they have in terms of the country getting better is just incredible. It's very infectious. It's something to experience for sure. So yeah, I mean, it was just an incredible time to go. I think this year is a great time to go also because it's just such a gorgeous giant country that's just opening up, and it's also very cheap, by the way. The one thing that's not cheap is mobile phones, but apparently it's getting cheaper. You can't, as a foreigner, I don't think you can technically buy a SIM card, but you can rent one. It used to be that you had to pay $1,000 for a SIM card. I think now it's $500.
Wow, that's so expensive. And that's just because the government's controlled things so much.
They did not want people communicating. I mean, not just foreigners, but their own people. But now it's becoming. I mean, it's opening up. There are apparently more than a few companies that are coming in, And Yangon, which is the capital, is a very modern city to a large extent.
Wow. Well, it sounds like you had an amazing trip, and the photos you had up on Facebook were amazing too. I mean, it just looked like the most exotic, amazing trip around the world.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I mean, I think Burma, I said this on Facebook, I think is probably one of the most photogenic countries left on Earth, just because it's in such a transition. It's that everything there is just every sort of corner you find a great photo op. So if you like photography, I think that would be the one place you want to go.
Most definitely. So on our show this week, we'll talk about there's a couple big items that we'll discuss. One is one of our favorite subjects, which is cord cutting. There was a new survey from Convergence Consulting Group showing that 1 million people had left cable last year in 2011. And we'll talk to Seth Shapiro, a strategist and someone we saw at the Picnic conference a couple years ago, and he'll talk about what he sees in those numbers. And then next we'll talk about a new business model that isn't totally new, but Google is offering up what they call customer surveys, where people can take surveys rather than pay for paid content or content that's usually behind a paywall. And we'll talk to David Cohn from SpotUs, who helped pioneer that model. First, let's start with cord cutting and whether it's gaining momentum. So the Convergence Consulting Group has come out with this survey, or kind of in-depth report, saying that 2.65 million Americans cut the cord between 2008 and 2011, with more than 1 million leaving cable in 2011. By the end of 2012, the number's forecast to reach 3.58 million cord cutters. And conversely, between 2000 and 2009, cable companies in North America added an average of 2 million subscribers a year. But lately, that growth has definitely been slowing. Subscriber growth for cable between 2010 and 2011 was 112,000 subscribers, so that number is actually slowed considerably. Now we turn to our guest Seth Shapiro, who's a leading strategist, speaker, and advisor in digital media. He's a principal of New Amsterdam Media, an adjunct professor at the USC School of Cinematic Arts, and a research fellow at the Annenberg Innovation Lab. His work includes projects in games, TV, online, and mobile for companies like Disney, Comcast, McCann, Intel, and a range of startups. Welcome to our show.
Hi guys, good to talk to you again.
So Seth, what do you take from this, from these numbers? I know you've written some really, you wrote a piece for Media Shift about, the death of cable is a bit of a myth, and that all, we talk about cord cutting all the time. We're both cord cutters, but you're kind of the wet blanket, the guy who's just like, that's not the reality. The reality is the cable companies are actually doing, pretty well, and their business model is not going away. Do these numbers present anything new for you?
Well, probably not. I mean, I guess I would say a few things. One is we're all digital, we're all digital guys, and so it's really nice to think about a world that's going to evolve as fast as we might like. But one of the sort of embedded stories that gets lost here is that the same companies largely that control cable control the majority of the content that's really good. And so if we were, sitting here having this conversation in the 70s, watching Charlie's Angels and Dynasty or whatever, it would be a lot easier to probably argue, you know what, this stuff is garbage, and so people are going to willingly turn away from it for another a better alternative. The fact is, that sort of makes it more of a shade of gray. Shows like Mad Men or Breaking Bad or whichever ones you happen to like, they've largely been subsidized by this existing cable model, and now increasingly, the revenue of the large media companies that make those shows, that produce those shows. I mean, they have a huge vested interest in keeping the old model alive. And so I think one of the things that you were sort of speculating on, Mark, was this notion of, you know, how can, you know, have Hulu and Netflix peaked? And so I think, you know, like one of the things that I was saying about a year ago when Netflix was really being widely viewed popularly as this growing alternative to mainstream media was, you know, at any point, like if I manufacture widgets and then you're the guy retailing the widgets, who really has the economic control in the equation? And it's really, it's the guy who makes them, right? So it's these major media companies that sell cable or partner with cable that control those shows. And so indeed, you've seen as Netflix has sort of become more and more of a viable threat to the old model, more and more of those shows are being taken back. So Starz has pulled out. HBO has never worked with Netflix. Showtime is working with them less. And so there's sort of this vested interest in keeping the old model alive, even though none of us may love it so much. And then I guess the last thing I would say relative to those numbers is – cable, you know, cord cutting may be on the rise and there may be fewer, there may be more disconnections, but the truth is that that's largely, in many cases, connected to the general economy and the housing market, right? So if I move my house, I'm getting rid of cable, and a lot of people are moving out of their homes. And so a good chunk of those numbers you could really attribute to the fact that the economy is in the state that it's in.
Yeah, and even, you know, when they say a million people cut their cord, let's say, or dropped cable and satellite last year, I mean, they're still, what, like 100 million subscribers. So that's still a drop in the bucket when you look at the big numbers.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, so, you know, the sort of standard number is there's probably between so anywhere between 105 and 115 million paying, you know, subs, and that sort of varies. So we're talking about probably a 1% shift. It's not huge.
Well, some of the numbers are also suggesting, Seth, that the Netflix and Hulu viewership is also peaking as well. So how do you sort of reconcile those numbers with, I guess, the larger cord-cutting numbers, which in general aren't that large to begin with anyway?
Well, yeah. So, I mean, I think one of the issues for Netflix is the fact that a lot of the good content is being pulled back. You know, if you go on to Netflix looking for new stuff or breaking stuff, you're going to be disappointed in many cases. In the case of Hulu, which, you know, as you know, is owned by big media, that was sort of, I think, one of the rational, you know, that was sort of one of the rational moves of the, you know, the mainstream media business saying, look, we've seen what's happened to music, because music, as you guys both know, obviously could have partnered with Napster and we probably would have lived in a different world. Had the music business united around giving consumers some sort of rational, efficient model, then things might have been different. But instead, they really viciously clung to the old model. And so people just sort of went around them. And so Hulu was sort of an attempt on the part of Fox and NBC originally to say, all right, what can we do to get a horse in this race and come up with something that gives people this content so they don't go around us and get the content illegally, but still keep some economic value in the game for us. And so, you know, Hulu is definitely you know, in a weird place in the sense that there's ad sales divisions at Hulu and then there's ad sales divisions at the major networks that control Hulu. But, you know, they sort of represent, you know, a move by the traditional media to keep pace with this. Now, there was economic pressure, obviously, to make more money against that because, I mean, you guys probably saw Steve Levitan, who's you know, sort of the showrunner for Modern Family famously was tweeting a while ago saying, hey, I don't want my shows on all of these things. The way that me and my folks make money is by having this show have some scarcity. We want people to watch it on the network. We'd eventually like to go on syndication. So if people can watch it in other places, it's actually undercutting, you know, the livelihood we're going to get down the road. And if you have a big TV show, you're all about what you can do in the next few years. And so there's been definite pushback against these sort of you know, digital methods, and so that was sort of one of the reasons that Hulu Plus came about, which is this paid mechanism, right? So you pay basically what you'd pay for Netflix for Hulu, and I think they're claiming now over a million paying subs. But yeah, I mean, there's evidence that maybe you know, it's not growing as fast as it once was, certainly.
And it seems like the one of the issues with that is that You know, they haven't been able to get all the content that they could get. That now, because the studios and other people are making, I guess they're realizing how much they can get from Netflix and Hulu. This isn't about, oh, we're adding a little bit of revenue. Like, we would like to have, I mean, it sounds like the prices are going up in some way.
Yeah, in a major way. And so what Netflix did was to prove and validate the economic value a lot of this content in a nonlinear world. And so to your point, the studios that control that content are saying, "Hey, why don't we keep that money? Why are we giving it away?" And so one of the things that, you know, we could have predicted a year ago, but that has happened now is Comcast has launched its own competitor to Netflix. And, you know, in addition to being the largest cable service in the United States, Comcast is also the largest provider of broadband and now the owner of all of the NBC networks, so CNBC, MSNBC, NBC itself, Bravo, USA, Sci-Fi, on and on. And so at the end of the day, they can elect to just not give that content to Netflix or to charge more for it or to put it on their own service. And so that definitely makes it harder for these sort of over-the-top models that encourage cord cutting to thrive.
So our dream of having, like, you know, all the content that we want on demand for the price that we think is fair, that dream is going to be very hard to make reality outside of just, oh, well, let's just go download it somewhere from a pirate site.
Well, the ideal for big media would be, and you know, you'll see more and more moves towards this, would be this notion that all of the content you could watch linearly on traditional cable, you would be able to watch online, right? Because it doesn't matter to them at the end of the day, as long as you're paying for it. So if I'm paying $100 a month to watch content on cable, or I'm paying $100 a month to watch content on cable or online, as long as I'm paying them, they're feeling okay. One of my students at USC actually had sent me an article a few weeks ago when the Mad Men premiere had happened, noting, you know, that the premiere of Mad Men this year was streamed. And so the question is, did they get special dispensation in order to do that? Obviously, you know, if AMC can market their content directly to customers, then that's great for them. But, you know, Comcast, DirecTV, and so on, they want to keep those folks on the reservation paying for that stuff. And so that's where that frontier war kind of happens.
So do you think any of the other players in the market can have the wherewithal or the muscle to sort of upset this cable stronghold at this point? Google, including Google, YouTube, Amazon, and Apple. I mean, three very large companies are very large checks to write, and all of them are trying in their own ways.
Right. Yeah. So to just go down the list, this is a great question. I mean, you know, as you know, Steve Jobs was the largest shareholder in Disney, based on the Pixar acquisition. I was obviously really passionate about getting an Apple. He was very much trying to get a sort of a TV product out that would encapsulate a lot of the stuff that you would watch on traditional cable. And even given his relationship, his close relationship with Disney, that was hard to get off the ground. I think they were aiming for a $30 a month price point. ESPN, just as sort of a data point, in and of itself is so expensive that it makes those things hard. And that's another piece of this story. Cable networks, and this is sort of an underappreciated fact, cable networks are by far, at this point, the most valuable properties in the entertainment business. You know, they're more valuable than movie studios. They're more valuable than game companies because you think about all of those 100 million or so subs throwing off. So what happens is if I pay $100 a month or whatever to a specific distributor, Comcast or DirecTV, a certain number of cents or dollars per month are going back to whoever owns each one of the networks that I get. So in the case of sort of a garden variety network, maybe that's 10 cents a sub, 10 cents a month from my $100 that's going back. Maybe it's a quarter. But in the case of ESPN, it's closer to $5, you know, somewhere between $4 and $5. And they're actually trying to ramp it up way higher. So if you think about it, every family in the United States that pays for cable or satellite is paying maybe $60 a month for ESPN, whether they want to watch it or not. And so that's really good for Disney. who own ESPN to keep us all having to do that. And so to answer your question, that's sort of the battle. How can a Google or an Apple create a model that throws these guys enough revenue so that they're okay potentially undercutting this existing model, which is just sort of like, you know, a cash flow machine?
Yeah, and that's something that I guess we'll just have to keep watching to see what they can do.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, so and probably if they're willing to throw enough money at the problem, that stuff will get solved. If Google were willing to pay more than market rate for a particular network, they'd get the network. They just have to figure out how to make it make economic sense for them, you know, via some sort of new ad model that traditional TV couldn't offer. And so we'll see more and more attempts to do things like that, but it's a harder problem to solve than you know, some people sort of imply.
No doubt. Well, thanks for joining us. Appreciate you coming on.
Sure, my pleasure.
So next we're going to talk about Google offering surveys as an alternative to paywalls. Google recently rolled out its customer surveys where people answer a few questions in a brand survey rather than pay for content that's behind a paywall. They charge 10 cents to 50 cents for each person that's surveyed to the marketer, depending on how well targeted the person is. And then they pay the publisher 5 cents per person, and obviously keep the difference. It's a business model that was pioneered by Spot.us and its community-focused sponsorships. And joining us to talk about it is David Cohn, who is the founder and director of Spot.us, a nonprofit that was pioneering community-funded reporting. In academics, he's a lecturer at UC Berkeley's Journalism School and was a fellow at the University of Missouri's Journalism School at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Welcome back.
Hello.
Hey. So, David, what was your, first tell us about what Spot.us did when it comes to community-focused sponsorships and just, you know, how that started, how it did for you guys.
Sure, and it was a little different from the Google survey thing, but very similar in nature overall. What we did, you know, Spot.us is this idea that the public has full editorial say about which stories we do or don't do. Because they control the pocketbook. And the main way they did that was by donating to the story of their choice. But, you know, soon we realized that and what that meant is that we couldn't do advertising, because traditionally the advertising budget would have come to me, the publisher, and then I, David Cohn, would sort of decide how to spend it. And that sort of went against the whole, you know, theory behind Spot.us. But what I sort of recognized was, well, if we could track you know, engagement with an ad, then we could sort of reward users with credits, right? So taking a survey from one of our sponsors, we had a sponsorship from AARP, for example. If you answered some questions for AARP, you would get $5 in credits. It wouldn't be cash for the user, but then they would have $5, which they could then apply to the story of their choice. So they could fund a story without having to spend their own money, but by taking the survey. And what was really interesting about it was just the percentage of people that would participate and time it again. So whereas we found we could get a little under 1% of people to donate, and they would typically donate on average $40 each, and they would, in the lifespan of being on Spot.us, they would donate twice. So a single donor was worth about $80. A single survey taker, about 10% of people that would come to the site would take a survey. And they were worth $5 a survey, but they would typically do pretty much every survey that came out. So, you know, when we had 10 or 15, after a while, they started to be just as valuable as someone who opened up their pocketbook over a period of time.
So why were you able to charge $5? So you're charging these people, like the AARP and people who did surveys, you're actually charging them $5 a person?
Yeah. And that's higher than the Google thing, although... And this goes to, you know, I think one of the subtle differences between what Google is doing and what we did. And actually, I think, you know, Google might be on the smarter end of it, to be honest. You know, what we did was, it was much more about marketing and advertising. So you would see that it was an AARP-sponsored survey. And these questions were directly for AARP, and it sort of had some branding involved with it. Whereas the Google surveys, you know, if you look at them, they're much more sort of broad or generic. It's like, you know, do you like ice cream? Yes or no. It's not like, it's not about, you know, how often, it's not about Haagen-Dazs ice cream. It's just about ice cream in general. So Google is really going for the sort of broad data approach, which, you know, I think they have sort of the scale to be able to do that. Whereas for us, you know, it wouldn't have made sense because I would have, we wouldn't have gotten enough data to then turn around and sold that data.
Yeah, it just seems like that's a pretty good five. I understand. Obviously, the surveys that you guys ran were a little bit more complicated than what Google is doing. You know, we just Rafat and I were both noticing that when we went to Adweek to read the story about the Google surveys, you immediately after reading the first paragraph, you have this big thing pop up saying, you know, asking. I think it was like whether you liked a certain logo or not. On I think the one I saw was, you know, would you rather have a cereal that had this logo or this logo about its organic, you know, content? And you just kind of chose it. And I think you can even X out of it. I don't know that you even have to do it necessarily, but it's definitely, it interrupts what you're trying to read, but it's also very simple and
easy. It's incredibly simple. It's one question, and actually there are ways to sort of get around it. There's usually an option. You can either share the page to sort of get around it, although that's weird because why would you share a page that you haven't read yet? Or you can sign up for the News Publications newsletter. So we're talking about implementing this at UC Berkeley at the Hyperlocals. And if you don't want to answer the question, you could sign up for one of their newsletters, and that will also get you past the content.
How popular do you think this option now that Google is offering it compared to some of the smaller players who were offering it to begin with, some more complicated than others? How popular do you think this can become, and sort of how much do you think it would end up helping the content industry?
Well, I mean, I think a big part of it is yet to be determined, which is to say, I'm curious to see how people respond to it, because it's funny too, when I talk about this now and I say, hey, you know, people, would you be interested in taking a survey as opposed to doing a paywall? And immediately everybody says, no, no, no. Because when we say survey, we sort of, it conjures up this like long 40, you know, question, like having to answer census questions or something. Whereas what Google has, you know, survey is really not the right word.
They're calling it a micro survey, right? Because it's only like a couple questions.
Yeah, it's one question, so survey is not the right word. But you know, I think it's too early to tell. It'll really be determined by how people respond to it, and if people are willing to. I mean, it's just going to be looking at the bounce rates over a long enough period of time, and Google, I'm sure, you know, will be able to at least take this to a large enough scale where they'll be able to definitively say, looking at bounce rates, whether or not this is a good idea.
Well, I mean, what would you have done, Rafa, you know, at a site that you're doing or a site you're going to launch? I mean, would you consider doing this kind of thing?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I first saw it on Adweek on another story, and I didn't even know this is what was launched because I was out of the loop for a couple of months until this morning when you emailed me the links. But it just seemed very simple, and I didn't. It's as you guys are saying, one question doesn't really, you know, some lame question. I don't even remember what it was, but it's such a generic question. It was more pointed. I would have thought about it twice, but it was such a generic question that it didn't. I said, well, why even ask that question? But anyway, it probably would. Yes, and if the proposition is that the publisher gets a decent cut out of it, which it seems to be. Yeah, why not? I mean, especially if I can customize it through sponsors that I would get that would want surveys done, and in a non-intrusive way, then I would definitely want to do it.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that I think about, you know, for my audience is, you know, is it going to be something that's actually, that they care about? Are they going to really care about like a seal for something being organic? Or would they rather talk about something around media or around business models or just something that they're already thinking about? So it feels like if they can target, somehow do a little better job of targeting. I'm guessing with Google, you know, if they think of it the way they do AdSense, if they can somehow get the subject matter aligned with the ad subject matter or the survey subject matter, then, you know, that's going to be a winning combination.
Right. And because it is less about necessarily advertising as it is about collecting data, they're more flexible to do that.
I think, I mean, there has to be one, like, I'm just thinking as a publisher, if I'm, for instance, the company that I'm launching is in the travel industry. So let's say if I have a survey saying, hypothetical example, saying, would you consider going to Iceland this year? Let's say Iceland Tourism Board has paid me and I want their survey on. And if you say yes, then what? Should there be an extra step saying, okay, click here to find more information, or you just sort of let that go? But anyway, I think there has to be some more complexity added for publishers to be more interested in it. But that's just my thought.
Yeah, like you could add in a cost per action, or what they call like a CPA part of it, where, you know, they're paying if you not only do you do the survey, but then you also click through for more information, or you call them, or you go to their site, or like, you know, like what David was saying, if they say, you know, well, you sign up for their newsletter to get out of it. I mean, that's another thing where, yeah, the publisher's getting something out of it if they're getting a new subscriber for their newsletter or something like that.
Yeah, I would totally do the newsletter thing. Yeah, that would be perfect use for it. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's the start of a different kind of conversation with readers. You know, I mean, I think the conversation is moving from sort of a few years ago it was, you know, just sort of complaining, you know, everybody wants everything for free and we can't do that and blah, 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 to, you know, this is sort of an opening sort of conversation about a give and take, a yin and yang of, you know, what can people give that will help publishers, and, you know, providing some data or signing up for a newsletter, et cetera, is sort of the start of that negotiation, along with, of course, metered paywalls.
Well, thanks a lot for joining us, Dave.
No problem. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift. I want to thank our co-host Rafat Ali, back from vacation, as well as our guests Seth Shapiro and David Cohn, as well as PBS and the Knight Foundation for making this podcast possible. Be sure to check out all the news, polls, and events over at PBS Media Shift at pbs.org/mediashift and our sister site IdeaLab at pbs.org/IdeaLab and our news site Collaboration Central at collaborationcentral.org. We'll be off next week for our Collab Space event, but we'll catch you in 2 weeks.